Without going through it as a child or as an elderly Australian, it's hard to imagine the horror of being kidnapped and being forced to live far from home, forbidden to speak your own language, unable to contact family or parents. And, well, for the kids, it was at an age where stories your mum and dad told you about the night to keep you close and safe now bounced around your head with you in a padlocked dormitory far, far away from those safe arms. It's even hard to imagine a child in that situation mustering the courage to escape and make what, for most, would be an impossible journey from Moore River back to Leonora or Laverton on foot. They were the stories that had gone untold. The people that perpetrated the crime, like A.O. Neville, were slipping off the perch quickly and weren't about to tell the truth. Luckily, the stories of these brave, strong, tenacious, incredibly bright folks hasn't been lost to Greater Australia. In 2000, Carolyn Wadley Dowley published Through Silent Country, a book that brought to life the harrowing first-hand accounts of people stolen from the country north of Kalgoorlie. Last year, the revised edition of Through Silent Country was released, and multi-award-winning author Carolyn Wadley Dowley joins me in the studio right now. Good morning, Carolyn.
Hello, Jeff.
Mate, I am extraordinarily well after reading your book over the last week. The personal stories in Through Silent Country are incredibly gripping. That you transcribe the text directly from the taped conversations without adding flourishes and editing is a leap toward truth that had previously gone untold.
Yes.
They're beautiful stories that have come straight from the lips of these people.
Yeah, I was really determined that their voices should come through to the reader in the same way that they told me the stories, that they shaped them and they worked out their priorities and what they wanted to tell me and what they wanted to tell all the readers behind me, because they knew it was for a book. They told me, this is, you're going to write a book and you're going to put our stories in there. And so what they shaped for the readers, I wanted to get exactly out in that form too.
And as the book travels, as it does, you start with a very in-depth explanation of, well, the entry point to receiving the stories, because as we're aware, there's a lot of sensitivity around what people that may have passed, and also sharing stories that aren't necessarily your own, or they didn't feel was theirs to tell.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about that lead up to you taking the first trip out to the Central Australia.
Okay. I was actually an architect when I first read a little hint of this amazing escape story in a work that was a radio interview, actually transcribed, and it hooked me. So I gave up architecture, went to study history to learn how to track down a story like this, because I thought at that stage it was only 70 years. I thought it can't be fully lost. There must be people who still remember it. There must be some kind of record. It's too amazing a story to just ignore.
Float away. Yeah.
Yeah. So I talked to a few people, and some of them said to me, oh, you've got the wrong colour skin, you can't really do this kind of work. But Professor Tom Stanage at UWA said, well, do all the archival research, do all the going through the government records, anyone can do that, the records are there, they're available, there's no, you know, difficulty that and with that. And I told him also how I wanted to go out on the country and see the landscape that, yeah, they walked through, and kind of measure the distance with my soul, and see if I could track down that railway line that they were sent away on, and the landmarks in the story. I ended up going into the lockup that they were held in, which I wasn't expecting at all. Which
it's
was
the Laverton one.
Yeah.
Like where they locked the door behind them.
Absolutely.
Oh, my God.
And that was it.
Sorry, I'm just retelling a part of Through Silent Country there, where people in Laverton were, told to come to the police station to collect rations. And when they went to collect rations, they had the iron doors closed behind them. And they were trapped.
Yeah, and for people who were out in the country living on the land with a huge sky and huge horizons, to get into that tiny lockup with it was so dark in there and it was so tiny, and it just absolutely was harrowing and broke my heart. I was kind of felt like I was frozen for the rest of the day.
And that's like from the comfort of now.
Yeah, that's right. I went out there hoping to find... I didn't expect to find that, but I was hoping to see some of the things that they experienced. And while I was there, I met some amazing Wangata ladies who welcomed me in and sat me down at their kitchen tables and introduced me to their cousins and their sisters and told me, you know, tomorrow you can talk to this person and tomorrow I'm going to send you to this auntie. And had an amazing time. They told me their stories, telling me, we've been waiting for someone to come and listen to us. It's about time someone listened to us.
Well, because I was going to ask you, did you get a feeling if it was the right time or you were the right person?
Well, I had this amazing sense of being welcomed in where there was no logical reason for them to welcome me in, really, you know, given their history they'd experienced. And they told me that if they saw a policeman, it was terrifying for them even. So to sit on the other side of the kitchen table with these lovely ladies and to drink tea with them and have them share their stories with me was such an honour. And I've continued connected to those families, which continues to be an amazing honour.
How could you not?
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't do any recordings the first time I was there. They said, come back in whenever, 8 weeks or something, and bring your tape recorder that time. So there's been a number of journeys, and the journeys are still going on. Well, I was up there just last month.
There was such good reason for that suspicion, though, wasn't there?
Absolutely.
Because there'd been people that had gone up there and said they were going to, you know, spread the story, but never went back.
Yeah, that's right. Too much of that.
Broken promises.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, so it was such an honour to have members of the same families launching the new edition of Through Silent Country in Kalgoorlie and in Perth.
Well, the subject of Moore River is understandably traumatic for the people put through that torture. There must have been many that you came across that the experience is still too painful to recount, or you know, the families just don't want to go there.
Yes, definitely. There's silence continues around some very painful memories and other things people told me but said, this is not for the book. And so I carry some of that pain in silence now as well, but it's the pain that they have carried in silence and continue to carry in silence is immense and immeasurable. And some people have spoken out and kind of, I guess they've been able to articulate it, and they want people to know their stories, and they want people to be able to start to engage with what's really happened in the past, and that compels them past the pain to themselves in the telling to, some of the aunties said to me, it's good to get it off our chest, or it's important that Australia knows the truth of what's happened. Auntie Sadie Canning, for example, said at that time she was on the Reconciliation Council, and she was saying half of Australia, she thought, didn't actually know what had happened, and that was what she was advocating in the education process, to start talking about what had happened. And I think, you know, 25 years later, it's quite amazing to see how far we've come on that.
Well, actually, I was going to ask you that. I mean, Australia is a very different place to what it was 20 years ago. I mean, just looking at the referendum that's coming up. Was there much pushback against you or the first-hand accounts in your book when it was first published? Because there's, I mean, like people, family of A.O. Neville, for example, they've got a legacy. They were, well, in not telling the truth, they've been trying to hide that truth and protect a peachy, rosy, keen legacy.
I'm sure there was, but it didn't reach me, I think. I have heard from some of the archivists at the State Archives Records Office that people were saying, the families of Neville and others were saying, why are you letting all these records out? But they didn't contact me, and the people who did contact me were generally overwhelmingly positive, saying, we never knew this kind of thing happened. Or I had people from who'd grown up in Laverton writing and saying, oh, my grandfather told me that story of, the shooting of Tom James that Randy McIntyre had talked about in his testimony. This was from some of the settler families in the area confirming and saying, you know, what a shocking thing it was. So yeah, I had people writing to me saying, "This is so good that this is getting out."
It's interesting as well. I mean, you talk about people that are, well, weren't like A.O. Neville and not didn't hold the opinions that the state government held at the time. I mean, I refer specifically to the letter that the union sent from the Kalgoorlie Trades Hall, who voted unanimously to, like, lecture the government on doing the right thing and comparing the state government to King Leopold in the Congo.
Pretty strong.
That was some strong stuff. Another guy, William Harris.
Yes.
Knew the story. I mean, it's not like people didn't know back then that this was going on. And there were people that were allies. Were they just squashed down?
Yes. So you've referred to a couple of letters that were sent to the government, and some of them were published in the papers.
Oh, the one of the Sunday Times with the editors. Please tell people about that.
Oh, the one where the editor makes the little introductory note about, well, here's a letter from somebody who's entitled to speak on this, but, you know, no one knows whether it really happened or not. And
it happened.
And it happened, yeah. And, yeah, so there was that kind of... The government generally didn't respond to any of those letters that I've put into the book. When I looked through those old newspapers, there were no responses, but they in the government files, which I were amazingly opened for me when I started to do the new edition. And that's an interesting story. I don't know if we've got time for that.
Please.
Today. Oh, okay. When I went to do the new edition at the request of the families, because they couldn't get copies of the books anymore, and the aunties had originally charged me, you know, tell these stories so people can know it. And I thought, if they can't get books anymore, that, you know, I haven't really lived up to this charge. No. So I thought, okay, in 2020, when the book was going to be 21 the next year and the story of that big first escape was going to be 100 years old, I thought, okay, now's the time. I'll try and do a new edition, do a reprint. But all the files that I'd kept so carefully couldn't be read anymore by modern software. So then I had to go back to the state archives, find all the police record books, find all the Magumba records again, and, you know, request them all out from the storage and turn all those fragile pages and go through all those lists of names again and take the photos again. And it was harrowing all over again to see all those names of people incarcerated for no good reason at Moore River. And while I was doing that, in the first edition, we had to edit out all the names of the people who weren't connected with the stories, because at that time, there was more feeling that didn't necessarily want everyone's history on display. And so I only showed the names of the people who had given me permission to work on their stories. But now all those names are getting published on Noongar websites, and there's a strong feeling of, we want all the stories to be evident, and all the stories are traces of stories so that people can find them and start looking for them, like I started looking for a little trace in a book 25 years ago. I talked to the archivist about whether I could show you all the names this time, perhaps to so that people could see, you know, Mary and all these different family groups and women and children were all in there, as well as the 1921 people that I was looking for. And the State History Aboriginal Research Service got back to me after a meeting, and they unanimously voted that, yes, they wanted all the names shown this time. So that was quite amazing.
Well, and that having to go back and go through those archives actually, like, found some more gold, didn't it? I mean, this is added to the book. There's not stuff missing, there's more.
Yeah, because then they said, well, if you're going to do a reprint, we're going to open some new files for you. They'll be ready tomorrow. Here's the number. And it was the state government, A.O. Neville's department, the Aborigines department, as it was called then, the chief protector and the deputy chief protector of Aborigines. This new information, so I was sitting there with my heart just pounding. What is going to be in this file? It's going to be heartbreaking, and it also might be really important, and it might answer all these questions that have gone unanswered for 25 years. And
That's how the book reads as well. I find the personal stories, even though they're harrowing, they're quite warm. Because you're in conversation with somebody and they're sharing what they want you to know. I found the second half, though, cold. Because it makes you so angry. Even the positive letters, like from the Trades Hall in Kalgoorlie, it's like, for heaven's sakes, there were people pointing at this.
Yeah.
It does make you very angry seeing what settler, like, community did to this place.
Yeah, I think you're right. Having the voices of the people who lived through it and who could talk about it and could still welcome me is warm, because they were triumphant. They survived it. They learnt how to live with the past, and they communicated in a way that wasn't just about information. It was about receive this, but receive it in this way that you can actually keep going. Whereas the records are heartless and... they're so cold, and I literally did feel like I was freezing up inside the days I sat in the archives, turning those pages, seeing those signatures, deciding to shift people from their family, from their culture, from their land, for no good reason, 1,000 kilometres away, just, you know, for government reasons, and to find that it was something that the government planned and organised in, you know, premeditated, rather than a random act of some strange policeman who was just getting a bit, wild in the edges of the desert, right, a long way away. Yeah, with no one watching him. It wasn't that at all. It was coming from the top.
This was a telegram coming out saying, you have to go and do this, round these people up, bring them into town.
Yes.
That it was a policy. Carolyn, it is a fantastic book, and anybody who's interested in being an ally, it's definitely one they should all pick up. There's so much more to talk about your other writings, but I'm afraid we're going to have to leave that for another day.
Yes, there's a lot more stories. There's always more stories, Jeff.
Thank you so much for the work you've done for Western Australia and us learning the true nature of our history.
Thanks.
That was Carolyn Wadley Dowley talking to us there about her book that's been re-released through Silent Country. It is a revised edition and it is a substantial read, but if you are interested in the true history of this state, you'll go out and get yourself a copy today. Now.